Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And breathe. Welcome back to another episode of the Front Three podcast, and I would imagine you can guess what we're here to talk about already. It's the shock exit of Spain, 2010 winners of the tournament against host Russia. Joining me is easily one of the best people to break this down and work out where it went wrong for Spain, where it went right for Russia, and everything in between. I'm joined by none other than Nico Morales. How are you doing, Nico?
I'm really sad, you know. It's never nice to see the country that you are emotionally attached to go out, and that was the case here. I felt like it was relatively undeserved, but I'm sure we'll get into that. But yeah, just generally me and my mother, who I watched the game with, are pretty sad, so yeah.
You talked about the emotional pull. I can imagine that's incredibly strong. As you said, you have quite a strong affinity with Spain as a nation. I think you can talk to us from your first memories being wearing a Raul jersey and seeing them play in person. When we look at things from slightly more of a tactical standpoint, I think the thing that stands out to me and what seemed most prevalent on Twitter was criticisms of the tactic, specifically what felt like possession for possession's sake. You're obviously someone that is very focused on the tactical side of things. Did you see frailties? Did you see issues that kind of jumped out to you and sort of stood out as being things that Spain needed to address quite quickly in the game?
I think I understand the sentiment that a lot of those people are trying to get across. I think there was a general frustration, as there always is with Spain, to be more decisive, to be more direct, and not just to do those things. But I think from my perspective, at least, I didn't see any of that. I saw a team that was doing what they needed to do in order to try and break this Russian team down without overly exposing themselves. And I think this is more true in the first half than the second, but overly exposing themselves to the tactics that Russia were trying to employ. So I can understand the calls for, you know, I heard Ali Wagner, who was the Fox commentator. She said, you know, Spain need to pick up the tempo and they need to do this. And she was calling for them to be a little bit more direct. And like I said, I can understand this, the calls for that. But from my perspective, from the way that I saw Spain playing, I think you have to, as I kind of outlined in the article that I did for The Ringer about, you know, the impossibility of being a favorite at the World Cup, when those teams have to break down a tough defensive system, it's like I liken it to a very complex mathematical problem. Like Spain are out here doing, you know, theoretical physics, whereas Russia, in order for them to succeed, it's 2+2. All they have to do is be lucky in a direct counterattacking situation. So the approach is different, and I think that's maybe sometimes what people fail to understand, is that you have to move the opposition. You have to play those maybe more simple sideways passes to invoke a response. Just because you have the ball doesn't mean that you're the one that is necessarily inciting the change within the game. They wanted Russia to come on to them, so the certain bounce passes that they get back from the midfielders, those are the kind of actions that incite a quick response from Russia. And you have to be very technically gifted to be able to expose those little gaps in space. So I think for me, I think they, for the most part, they did everything that they could do in relation to the expectation that they had, both from a narrative perspective and tactically, in order to break that Russia team down. I think there are other questions as to the Russian doping and other things like that that we can get more into. But yeah, I think I'm largely satisfied with the performance that I saw.
Well, one man who saw things up close and personal was none other than our roving reporter, Elliot Hackney. And now, in a feat of audio mastery, I'm going to throw from myself to myself for the conversation I had with Elliot earlier on in the wake of the game.
This is England. They believe that they can win it. I don't want the party to end.
Elliot, first and foremost, mate, how was the game?
It was okay at first, but then, you know, going into the second half, it got really, really dire. I mean, I was there watching the game with Spencer of Hashtag United, who got me the tickets. And we'd both been out the night before, and we were literally falling asleep in the second half. It was all sideways from Spain. And when they announced that there was going to be extra time, we were like, oh, God, we don't even want another 30 minutes of this. But as we both know, it soon livened up when the penalty started.
How did the Spanish side of the crowd sort of go with things? Because you spot on when you say it felt like a slow, quite laborious game, lots of sideways passes. Did the crowd try and do anything to sort of get the Spanish team back into things and get them a bit of tempo?
Well, the majority of it was Russian fans, and there was continuous boos when Spain had a big amount of possession, and that happened quite often. But with the tickets that Spencer had got, he'd got them from Azpilicueta of Chelsea, we were surrounded by all the Spanish wags and girlfriends, and David De Gea's girlfriend was two rows behind us, and they were not happy. Yeah, they were not happy.
And okay, then what about the Russian fans? Because, you know, we've already talked about, you and I, the perception of the country, the danger. You've done some really good stuff on your channel about changing that perception about what the truth actually has been for your experience in Russia. What was the atmosphere like from that perspective? Do you think that could be an important game changer for this Russia side? Because it's not a quality laden side, this Russia team. But with that backing, it maybe could change things a little bit for them?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, the city's gone absolutely mental tonight. I mean, you can't turn a street corner without a car game past with either someone out hanging out the window with a Russia flag, or, you know, just seeing and hearing them shout Russia. I've continuously got Russia in my head because it's been non-stop since the game today. But yeah, the mood can really, you know, really, really help. And, you know, the Russian fans were out in the droves at the game, and they were cheering every single save, tackle, everything, as if it were a goal. So yeah, the city's gone mental tonight, and there's no doubt that that'll help spur on the side.
And looking forward for the rest of the tournament, obviously everyone back home has been very much shouting that it's coming home now, and that England have got this amazing chance, arguably the best since Italia 90, to make a World Cup final with the potential run-in that they could have if they can beat Colombia on Tuesday. How are you seeing that side of the bracket kind of fall out? Because obviously Croatia managed to get themselves through later on with a dramatic penalty shout. Are you confident that this England side can make that progress, that really this is their opportunity to make it to a final?
100%. I mean, if you look at all the other teams on our side of the draw, I without my rose-tinted glasses on, I seriously think England are the best side there. And I think if we don't make the final or the semis, it's going to be our own undoing, because with the quality we've got and the quality that we've already shown, I believe that we should be making the semis minimum. I think this is our best chance ever, and if we don't do it now, then I don't know when we're going to do it.
Oof, prophetic. One final question for you, mate. Spain, 2008, you could argue, is the start of their dominance. They take the Euros, they take the World Cup, they then take the Euros again. 2014 was a nightmare for them. 2018 has been arguably just as bad in certain ways, if not from a performance standpoint, just from a preparation. Do you expect now this change from them, at least from an identity standpoint, or do you expect to be in Qatar in 2022 seeing this same kind of possession-based style from Spain and them to carry on with things as they are?
For me, I think they need to develop and change. You know, the team seemed very mismatched today. I mean, the thing that stuck out to me was Diego Costa was up front, and we all know what he's best at, and that's, you know, balls coming into the box, headers and crosses, and that just wasn't happening, and he was so isolated and left apart from the rest of the team. And he would have been perfect in those closing stages if they were to play that way. When they took him off, he continued to try and play the passing possession football side to side, no real threat, no real end product. And for me, I think they've got to change if they want to, you know, if they want to keep up with the pace and, you know, do well in these competitions.
Well, someone who doesn't need to change is your good self. If the listeners want to hear more from you, see more from you, where's the best place to find themselves a little slice of Hackney?
Elliot Hackney, two L's, one T, Hackney like the place, and either on YouTube, Twitter or Instagram. But I'd say YouTube, go check out the vlogs, especially of that Spain game, because there are some of the reactions that I've got after the penalty was saved are incredible. Scenes, as they say it.
Can only endorse that even further. Well, Elliot, thanks very much for your time, mate. Have a good time at the rest of the tournament.
Cheers, Chris.
There we have it, the inside track from our man inside the stadium, Elliot Hackney. In the other corner, Spain made just over 1,100 passes in the 120 minutes. That is confirmed as a new official world record. You talked about Ali Wagner. Cesc Fabregas, who was doing BBC punditry, says it's time for Spain to cut out the tiki-taka, that for him there was a lack of threat. With what you've said, you've obviously covered that in great detail for us there. There was at the same time a slight concern about the connection between the Spanish midfield and Diego Costa. And you and I were WhatsApping at the time and kind of talked about the need for Iago Aspas to come in. We maybe, it might seem harsh to attribute a responsibility or a blame, but when it comes to Costa, we saw him very influential against Portugal, but here he very much felt like a pariah for large periods of this game. Is that for you, is that an issue with him and the fit of the team? Is that something that falls on Hierro and something that he needed to work on? Or is it as simple as they just can't play with that kind of striker? Because in fairness, this is not a new issue, I think, for the Spanish national team. We've seen Diego Costa and the midfield struggle to gel before and him struggle to be that sort of goal-scoring forward that we often see at club level.
No, yeah, I think it's... It's sort of the former of what you talked about. If you have, which none of you do, but if you had access to my email account, you would have seen I sent out a pitch right after the Portugal game to certain people that kind of outlined that even though he had scored a couple goals and even in the matches preceding that, he continued to be prominent in those games. Even though he's at the surface level was relatively successful this time around at this World Cup with the Spanish national team. For me, it was still a point of major concern as to his performances because of the lack of connectivity that they saw. I think sometimes when you're playing in Iran or perhaps even a Morocco or something like that, and you have a little bit more space, you have a little bit more ability to play into the strengths of someone like Diego Costa, I think playing him is fine. But like I said, when you have to break down these more complex defenses, playing a striker or someone that's going to occupy that forward space, at least centrally, who can link up with the midfielders a little bit better, I think is a far better advantage in terms of completing the attacks, because then the transition shifts from, you know, when you play with a striker like Diego Costa, I think your end goal is to imagine that the end of your move, the end of your passing play, ends at his feet so that he can get a shot on goal, because that's what you're trying to do. That's the purpose of playing someone like him. Whereas if you play a striker that is a little bit more pass-oriented, can link up with other players a little bit differently, it doesn't really matter who ends up with the ball at their feet at the end of the play, because you're going to probably end up closer to goal with a better chance at it. So it can end at the feet of a midfielder or Jordi Alba or an overlapping fullback or even a center back. So it's... For me, that was the concern, and I had that from day one. And I think the fact that he was scoring kind of papered over that concern.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And I think that this is probably where we're seeing one of the biggest changes from the pre-tournament furore over Lopetegui being sacked, is that Diego Costa would not have played very much if Lopetegui was still in charge. It would have been, from the people I've spoken to and his experience, it would have been either Rodrigo or Iago Aspas. So I think that's probably one of the biggest things. And, you know, that has an adverse effect as to how they've gone out now.
And then I kind of move my eyes to the middle of midfield. I looked at Koke, someone who I think is incredibly good for Atletico Madrid. He's a player I admire a lot. And yet it felt almost symptomatic to me a little bit of the Spanish midfield. There was lots of sideways passes, and I looked at him specifically. And someone made a point on Twitter that I thought was quite interesting in terms of debate, which was, for everyone that dislikes Thiago, it felt as if almost Thiago was the kind of player they needed, someone who wanted to take a risky pass. And that's my curiosity here, is that someone who understands these kind of things and the nuances of things, would it have been wise to put Thiago in there? Because if anything, I think Rodrigo looked like the change that really shifted them up a gear and gave them something they were missing. But could Thiago have had that influence as well?
Yeah, I think he would have been the change, maybe even from the start earlier on, that would have made the biggest difference. Because, as you're saying, you know, the riskier pass is probably an asset that they could have used, but also just the directness and similarity that he has to Isco. He's not the same player, but he has an affinity for maybe taking on players in midfield when certain players are isolated, because, you know, Spain were pushing players forward. They had both fullbacks very highly elevated, especially once Carvajal came on for Nacho. So when you have the defensive formation a little bit more stretched like that, and then you can have both Isco, Thiago, David Silva on the field, and they all have the ability to take on one or two players in midfield, draw a defender, do this, that, and the other, then you have more options centrally, and that's generally what you want from a team that, you know, needs more penetration. So I think that would have been the move, and it's strange to me. I don't know if there was an issue between him and Hierro, but yeah, I think that's probably another one of the things that Lopetegui would have instituted far earlier in the competition, is just the involvement of Thiago in general. So I definitely agree with the fact that his ability, I think, was something that was needed in this game.
Mm. And the last one I've kind of got for you on Spain is almost where next. You know, we've talked about the tiki-taka generation. I know that these are probably buzzwords that are infuriating you internally, but I made a joke to you about comparing it to the Roman Empire and this kind of thing. Where does Spain go next here, realistically? Because they still have a tremendous wealth of talent in terms of the individuals, but it feels as if they're at an interesting crossroads here, because they could potentially keep going with what they're doing, but it would seem, as you've written or written similar for the Ringer, that there is a changing dynamic in these tournaments, that it's becoming more about puncher, counter-puncher, and can that be sustained for Spain if they're going to face teams like this who will keep looking to sit deep and essentially suck the life out of the game?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question, because the immediate sort of, an not analogy, but comparison that we have for the failure of this Spanish team and the one in 2014, and, you know, they had an all right showing at Euro 2016, but I think people would have imagined that maybe they should have gone farther. But the first thing that you kind of think of is, okay, are they worse than what they used to be? You know, they used to dominate the international game so clearly. So are those players simply just not there anymore? And these ones that they have now, they're just not as good at implementing the same style? Or, and I think this is probably the more likely explanation, is that, you know, football has evolved a little bit. I think back then, since the possession style of football that was effectively balanced with a really solid counterpress that also served as its own, you know, form of chance creation, was something that not a lot of people knew how to effectively combat. You know, they knew to sit deep, but in terms of actually pressing at the right moments and being defensively capable in terms of like the 4-5-1 that kind of morphs between a six at the back almost, and you know, having certain positions in midfield, I think the general footballing knowledge or ability for teams to do that wasn't as known as it is now. So I think that's probably the more likely explanation, is that this group of players is exceptional, and Spain continues to be really, really good at perpetuating that style of possession football. The difficulty is, can they continue to do that when teams are simply better at combating that? And that's the question that they have to ask themselves, because, you know, as even if it is as, you know, as easy as saying, okay, we don't want to do that anymore, they will still always have the expectation, whether it be as a nation or just with a group of players, to play in some sort of possession dominant way. So I think, you know, I don't know if it requires really a top down look at the entire organization. I think probably the fact that, you know, the coach was sacked 3 days before is something that's far more concerning than the actual result of them going out right after the group stages. But yeah, I think that's kind of something that we can look at and say, you know, teams are better at combating this possession style. It's not as dominant as it once was. What can we do to maybe alter a little bit? Not a wholesale change, but just kind of change for the times, maybe a little bit.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing. Neither of these teams came into the tournament perfectly, in inverted commas. Spain obviously lost their coach in sort of the days before. I think it was 24 hours, 40 hours before. Russia, I don't think you could move for pieces that were talking about how poor they were. There was discussion about this team trying not to get embarrassed on home soil. I'm pretty sure I predicted them to finish bottom of their group, if not third at the highest, and even that feels like a push. And yet here they are, and I feel preempt what you would like to talk about with Russia, which is this doping that seems to hang over the team. And I think you alluded to as much on Twitter that there are impressive levels of stamina from these Russian players.
I think one guy, he responded to my comment and he said, you know, a 39-year-old played normal and extra time and he looked fine. So, I mean,
is there anything, if we just sort of put that in a jar of, we'll get to that. Was there anything away from that that impressed you about Russia? Was there anything that you thought, you know what, actually, there's something to be admired in the way that they've conducted this game?
Yeah, 100%. I think, like you said, putting it in a jar, irregardless of that situation, whatever the verdict may be, you know, there is still a tactical proficiency that you have to have in order to stifle a team as good as Spain. I think there's a maybe misconception of thought that if you turn up and simply are defensive or have the mindset to be defensive, then, you know, you're going to stifle a team that looks to pass it like Spain do. But that's just not the case. You have to be an acceptable professional team in terms of your spacing, your understanding of, you know, trying to minimize isolation on the team and stuff like that in order to stifle a team like Spain. That certainly was impressive. They always had pressure on the ball. They always kept a relatively compact defensive shape. They knew when they were getting stretched. That's the thing, is that, you know, you have to, as a team who is trying to play defensively, know when your defensive formation, when your defensive spacing isn't efficient anymore. If Spain are passing the ball backwards, when they're going all the way back to De Gea or back to their center backs, there's a certain point where you know, okay, we need to start putting pressure on the ball, because if they'll have an option somewhere, because it's just, we're not tight enough anymore. We just can't be tight enough at this juncture. And they knew that. They understood certain parts of the game where they clearly understood that dynamic. The difficulty for me is, like I said, in the latter stages of the game where things were a little bit more haywire, where things were a little bit more back and forth, they appeared, in the bias of opinion of a Spanish fan, to have some sort of biological advantage. So,
moving forward with them in the tournament, Russia, I think Golovin is largely seen as the star man, although Zuba is clearly the comedic relief, if nothing else. How do you see the rest of the tournament progressing for them? Because we look at the group of teams that are left, who they will potentially face. Obviously, Croatia, Denmark is still to be decided. Croatia or Denmark, that's a largely different proposition to Spain. Can they essentially replicate this performance, not in terms of quality, but in terms of style, again and again? Or is that going to be more difficult for them? Because obviously the level of expectation, or the gulf that you talked about, I think, with that piece for the Ringer about Spain and what have you, that kind of levels itself out and it almost becomes harder to be the underdog.
I think they'll still be the underdog regardless of the team that they go up against. I think the least favorable tie, and like you're saying, we'll probably cover it in this same podcast just a little bit later, but the least favorable opponent I think they could face is probably Denmark. I can't imagine they're going through against Croatia, but we'll see. But yeah, I think if Croatia were to go through, which is who I imagine it will be, I think that'll probably be an easier one because they can yet again be more defensive. And I don't think Croatia are as good as Spain at perpetuating that, like, fully offensive, let's hit them and just batten down the hatches against a team, or have it play against a team that is doing that. So I think they could even be more successful in that regard. So now the path for them to, dare I say it, the final or something like that is even, I think, a little bit clearer if they continue to face teams that just have to possess against them. So that's the difficulty there for them, is that I don't know if it gets that much harder.
And I couldn't let you just depart the scene without at least putting you on the spot once. Of the teams that are left now, obviously, the time of recording, Croatia Denmark is yet to be decided, obviously. Who do you think makes this final? And I know you're a firm believer that football could indeed be coming home.
I mean, I think it's all about the luck sometimes of the draw, and or not really the draw anymore, but sort of the path that you take. England has taken the more favorable one, which I think is a good thing. I think the talk of momentum is something that I massively do not buy into. So I think that the path that they're taking is a good one if they can get past Colombia. That being said, Colombia are no slouches. But at the same time, I've heavily favored, and the only doubt that I had for them was in fact the team that they played yesterday, Argentina. So France is definitely one of my favorites, and Brazil is still up there for me. But it's Uruguay, let me tell you, is going to be a tough game. Because, you know, and I'm sure we'll talk about that on a preview podcast or something like that. But yeah, I think France or Brazil is kind of where my winners lie.
Perfect. There we have it. Let us know what you think, though. You can obviously reach us on the Twitter account at The Front Three. You can tweet myself at Kay Hennage or Mr. Moran. I believe you've just gone under a Twitter rebrand. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I don't like the underscore. I've never liked it. So, and N. Morales is taken. Every variation of some form of my name without an underscore is taken. So I just did N of Morales because my middle name's Ofilio. So it's OF. But, like, I don't know. I might change it. But right now you can always find me at the Front 3 Twitter account. You can just click my work there, my profile.
Ah, there you go. Well, this has been us. You've been you. Until next time, enjoy your football. That's a magic number. Three. Yes, it is. It's the magic number. Three. Somewhere in this hip-hop soul community was born three, they stubbed me, and that's a magic number.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.